Welcome to Race and Democracy, a podcast on the intersection between race, democracy, public policy, social justice, and citizenship. Welcome to Race and Democracy. On today's show, we have a very special guest, my friend and colleague, Dr. Gabrielle Forman, who is an award-winning professor of English, African-American Studies, and History. A leader in the field of Black digital and public history, Dr. Forman has been recognized for co-creating projects that build community and institutions while addressing pipeline and equity issues. She is the Paterno Family Chair of Liberal Arts at Penn State University. She's a MacArthur Genius Prize Fellow. She's the founding co-director of the Center for Digital Black Research, hashtag DigBlack, BLK. Founding faculty director of the nationally acclaimed Color Conventions Project, and the author of many, many books, including a recent anthology on the Colored Conventions Project. She publishes extensively on issues of race, reform, and resistance in the 19th century, focusing on the past's continuing hold on the world we inhabit today. Welcome to Race and Democracy, Gabrielle.
It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, you're such a... You're a great guest because, one, you're a friend, and I've known you for a good number of years, and we have grown up together in the academy, together in so many ways from your time at Occidental. You know, I want to start by asking you about the Colored Conventions Project, but also because this doesn't happen to our people, and by our people, I mean Black people, African-American people, African people, that often. How does it feel to have your work recognized and to get the MacArthur Fellow? Because that's such a big deal, you know, and that a lot of times we don't own that or appreciate that or bask in that, and that's such a huge deal.
Thank you. It is humbling, I think, whenever we get the chance to be recognized for the work that we do, and particularly when we're historians of the past, right? So we see so many people toil without recognition, toil for the opportunities that we, in fact, are enjoying. And so to have that recognized nationally, particularly within a cohort of people who are doing work in a variety of fields, right? So if, in fact, we're devoted to the resurrection of Black history and its memory, we know how important culture and cultural workers are. And because the MacArthur also deals with people who are in political work, and by that I mean work for the preservation of democracy, right, is what I mean by that. And cultural work as well as academics. For those of us who are interested in preserving all of those facets of history, it is particularly generative and significant personally to be recognized amongst a group of people who work in all of those arenas. I'm the child of a poet, and so to be recognized, alongside creative artists and visual artists and people who preserve our histories through that kind of work or create abstract works, all right, is just really, really rewarding. But it's also humbling because none of us do this work alone, and I particularly don't do this work alone, and have been part of collectives since the very beginning of my career. And so to be recognized individually for so much work that I've done over many, many years in collectives also creates a certain kind of dissonance, right? So I'm delighted and humbled, and thank you for asking.
You know, I love that you use the word resurrection and sort of preserving Black history, because the Colored Conventions Project, which we're going to get deep into, does that in many-fold ways. I've had a chance to not only look at the website, but also experience one of your workshops, which are incredible. Before we dive into the CCP project, what do you think about this pivotal moment in our history where we're generating both, to me, the most Black history we've ever seen globally, just globally, the most information, the most detailed information, the most non iconic or even male or heteronormative patriarchal actors in that story, which is very, very exciting. And then at the same time, we are facing this effort to ban Black history that is connected to the anti-DEI and connected to voter suppression and connected to this racial backlash, which you document in the Colored Conventions Project. But what do you think, why do you think that's happening all at once? Because I think it's extraordinary because you, even as a MacArthur Fellow and the CCP, is an example of genuine progress. Genuine progress. Like, we've never had that before in the history of the world, to my knowledge. And at the same time, we're facing these book bans in certain states like Florida and Texas, where we're sitting right here in Austin, are really at the cutting edge of banning not just certain kinds of speech, but really at its core, it's Black history that has allowed so many different people's stories the wings to fly.
Right. I mean, I think all of us who are enmeshed in Black history are familiar with the lessons that come out of Ida B. Wells, right? Which is that success beckons the mob, to quote Caretha Mitchell. And Ida B. Wells points out that it is the success of businessmen, of business, of people who are entrepreneurs, that literally sends the mob to lynch those of her friends who are in Memphis, right, who are succeeding. It's literal competition, right, that beckons that mob. It's not the specter of Black sexual violence. It's the specter of Black entrepreneurial success. And so when, in fact, communities who have been excluded all of a sudden are equal players, you're going to see, and this is obvious to all of us who do this work, people excel. And we've seen it. It's been such a pleasure to see book awards and people at the head of centers, at the helm of centers, being able to train so many students. And that success is happening in multiple fields. And it is also addressing and surfacing the kinds of structural inequities that also are in multiple fields, from medical fields to economics to politics to voting to education. And these, of course, are the same areas, the same intersections of struggles for rights that we see being addressed in the Colored Convention movement, which begins in 1830, when people come together to protest almost 2,000 people being expelled from Ohio, not from the South. This isn't violence in the South. This is the violence which in a place that was then the West, which is the heartland right now of America, and being pushed out of Ohio and moved to Canada in 1829. And it's this state-sanctioned violence that brings people together from so many of the free states in Philadelphia for the first national convention. When we look at organizing initiatives, organizing movements from the past, and we go back to Reconstruction, which is another moment when we see what we're calling colored conventions because that's the language they use, but these Black political conventions that last 3 or 4 days, we also see people like Jonathan Gibbs, who is the head of education for the entire state of Florida, right? In the Reconstruction moment. And we've seen these backlashes before, right? So that when, in fact, people who are doing work to expand democracy, which is exactly what Gibbs is doing around public schools, for example, in Florida, which is improving the fate of the poor, you know, regardless of race, right? Which is improving equity and questions of access for all people, not just Black people, and is rising, right, the level on which all boats can float. We see an extraordinary backlash that is driven by elites in the false name, right, of the masses who claim an Americanness which is particular to them, right, both racial, you know, particularly racially.
And I want you to dive into that point because I think that's exactly right, and that continues to this day because in certain ways, the Black elite's success has always been sort of segregated from white poor people and white working class in certain ways. In terms of the way in which you couched it as saying, it's really white elites who are ginning this up. Because I think about that just with Black history in higher ed, because we don't teach a bunch of poor white people. And we, like, I've been in higher ed for over 30 years, and it's not like we are dealing with poor white people. We're not. Like, where are they?
You know, there was a moment where we were teaching class, race, and gender, race, class, gender, right? And those were three words that were sort of touchstones. And it actually, I want us to bring a critical lens to what diversity, equity, and inclusion necessarily means. I have a really good friend who is continually critiquing Black studies, I think, unfairly, by saying we also need to have class studies, right? And that there needs to be departments of class studies. And I want us to actually consider that in a significant way. What would it mean for us to have an academic discipline that we saw alongside gender studies, right, and African American ethnic studies, right, that centered class in ways that also dealt with race, right, medicine, education. And if, in fact, we considered those questions more fully, more disciplinarily, all right, we might make more space for the very people we should be aligned with in many ways, but who are always exploited, have historically always been exploited, and then become exploiters, right, in a very complicated dance with racial and class elites.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think, and I want to get back to the Colored Conventions Project, but I think that's very interesting because I think unless you're teaching at times at community colleges, at HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, that are not the cream of the crop, the elite HBCUs, so the non-elite HBCUs, you are really not encountering, because higher education is so segregated by race and class, right? You're really not encountering this whole idea of whether it's the white working class or even the Black working class. Sometimes we'll say, oh, we have these first gen students. I know I'm first gen, but we weren't coming from abject poverty.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
you know, so those of us mm-hmm. who get a leg up through higher ed,
yep.
we're doing better than we would have done without it. But I know some people who are coming from Section 8 and coming from food stamps. That's what we used to call them. Now they're called something else, SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. But for the most part, the people who we are, who are colleagues of ours and even students of ours are not coming from these really, really impoverished economic backgrounds in higher ed, which is, like you said, I mean, it this idea of class studies or really focusing on that in a very specific way is interesting just as a thought experiment.
And should be, right, you know, interesting in relationship to our responsibility to people from all classes. I mean, I did come from welfare and food stamps and, you know, that's my economic background. But I also came from an extraordinarily rich family in its devotion to intellectual inquiry. So my mom was in college for my, you know, literally my whole childhood and was reading me Langston Hughes poetry when I was, you know, 3 and 2 from a stolen library book that I still have, right? So of the collected writings of Langston Hughes.
Yeah, that's great.
And also, before she shifted to women's studies, which is the degree she graduated in, she was a history major and used to take me to classes at Roosevelt University, where I would leave school and get on the bus at 6.
Roosevelt University
in Chicago.
Was St. Clair Drake one of her professors?
He was not, but he was there, obviously, and was a friend of my father. I called him when my father passed because I found him in the phone book. I'm hoping I'm getting the years right. When did he pass?
St. Clair Drake?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Sterling Stuckey is who I called.
Okay, Sterling Stuckey,
yeah. Right, was there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, the richness of some of these schools that have educated, right, the working class, which is what I think you're pointing to. And I think we need to take that much more seriously. My first job was at Wayne State University, and I chose it, right, over much more elite schools, including places like MIT, right, because I was particularly interested in teaching working class students. And they were working class students. They were coming to class, right, after 40 hours a week of, right, working, or during 40 hours a week of working. But we were siphoned into elite institutions with the promise that we could join the elite, not with the promise that we could transform an economic structure that would actually create equitable situations for the vast majority of people. So when we were plucked out of those situations because we excelled academically, we were promised, right, the ability to join, right, the elite. And it seems to me that transformational equity, transformational democracy is the legacy that I'm much more interested in resurrecting. And that's what the Colored Conventions really does. It is a collective movement, not one that features, but it does not center individuals. And it really is not only about anti-slavery, and it lasts for 30 more years than after slavery's end. And it begins before the construction of the antebellum anti-slavery movement, the American Anti-Slavery Society, the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, the Liberator, right? It begins before all of these things. And it is struggling and centering equity in education, in voting and political rights, in labor rights, and again in freedom for state-sanctioned violence. So it's really centering an expansive conception of American democracy that goes beyond the end of slavery. It wants to talk about the beginning of the fullness of American democracy. And I think it's very important not only to think about what they were struggling for, but the way they initiated and enacted that struggle, which was through collective writing, collective organizing, right, and making sure that there were delegates from all factors of African American life who showed up at these meetings. And that kind of class differentiation is highlighted in the named delegates that we see in these state and in these national meetings.
So I want to ask you, I'm looking at the Colored Conventions Project right now, and for all of our listeners, it's coloredconventions.org, and you can check out the very extensive website. Now, it's divided into records and exhibits. I want to look at exhibits. When I see the exhibits, which are fantastic, there's so many interesting things that you never really think about in the context of the 19th century, or at least I think the general public doesn't. But there's one here that says colored conventions in the carceral states. And we live in a time of, I would call it a new abolition movement, but certainly Du Bois called it abolition democracy. But it's so interesting to see the way in which in the 19th century, this cross-class coalition and this coalition where Black women and men were really organizing together, and we even had some Black men like Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, who were very into an egalitarian notion of organizing. But I think it's fascinating to see the colored conventions in the carceral states, and it's important for us to see that these exhibits are both descriptive, but they're also very interactive. And you show multiple contexts of both, you know, written records, visual records, the historical context of what produced it, but also how people were traveling, even in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. So it's a remarkable sort of archive here of Black self-activity. I'll use the Jamesian phrase. And I want us to talk about that, especially with the carceral states. It also shows us there's nothing new under the sun. We were resisting this, you know, way before, you know, when we think about Michelle Alexander and New Jim Crow, Angela Davis, but even way before the 20th century resistance that somebody like Khalil Muhammad shows in The Condemnation of Blackness, late 19th, 20th. This you show early. So I'd love for you to talk about some of those findings and how they make us rethink abolition in our own context. But also, I think what I love about the Colored Conventions Project, it makes us rethink how we should probably be organizing, or at least have a branch of ourselves organizing collectively together. Yeah.
The first thing I want to say is that that excellent exhibit is by Samantha De Vera, who's now a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. And she was the head of our digital exhibits committee for many, many, many years while she was a graduate student. And we so there are 20 exhibits on the site. Thank you for highlighting some of them. And many of them are partnerships that are created in classrooms across the country in many of my classrooms, but also with digital technologists, with we need to think Gail Cengage and Accessible Archives. These are producers and preservers of historical records, but those records are often behind paywalls, and they have given us permission to publish almost anything out of their websites and to make them publicly available. All of these exhibits are freely accessible to anyone who wishes to access them, as are the records of so many conventions that were held in almost every state of the expanding Union and across Canada. So you see 200 sets of records for these conventions, and we've got a lot that are in the back end right now that are under development that will hit the site in the coming years as well. I think the question that you pose, and that Dr. De Vera also poses, is about the dynamism between people like Michelle Alexander and Khalil Muhammad, who are and Ruthie Gilmore, who are writing about carceral politics and carceral and the American imperative towards incarcerality or carcerality, which has put the United States on the map as the largest incarcerator in the world, and how their analysis and careful attention and research allows us to ask historical questions and unearth records that are in continuity with the analysis that is being for this is a syncretic and a synthesis of the ways in which contemporary scholarship informs and generates the questions that we ask about the past, even as the past informs the ways in which we ask questions about the present. And I love that dynamism that we see. The conventions themselves are almost all male-led. But if we ask questions about women, we see how the Georgia Convention, I believe in 1868, is foregrounding how women and children are incarcerated and organizing against this move toward black laws, toward the ways in which black people are being targeted and criminalized for everyday quotidian behavior. Now, I'm someone who started my collective work in a school in Los Angeles, and to see how the homeless are criminalized because they're unhoused, right? And then end up in prison because they're unhoused, or those who are experiencing mental illness and distress are being criminalized and end up in jail, is to look back at the 19th century and to think about the laws against loitering that are putting the recently freed into contracts for their former enslavers or in prison itself, where we are working for no money at all. So when we see, and under horrific conditions. So the kind of parallel, right, between those two centuries are surfaced again by the contemporary scholarship. And I think, as you have, we need to celebrate those scholars as we also resurrect that history.
And one of the things that you're doing, Gabrielle, is helping to teach teachers. And so I want to talk about that because it's such a controversial thing now, an issue, when we think about this idea of anti-racism and post-George Floyd, this backlash, but helping K through 12 teachers really have the language, exhibit by exhibit, it's very, very detailed, be able to, and I think about the 1619 Project, and I think about the Colored Conventions Project, because in so many ways, what 1619 does is provide this huge tapestry of sort of reimagining our origin story and reimagining democracy alongside of that. And here with the Colored Conventions Project, you're really giving K through 12 teachers, certainly graduate students too, and certainly scholars, but teachers who are going to teach more than scholars and graduate students do, because the public school system, I want everybody to know, there's more people who go to public school than who go to college. No, but I really want people to know that, because not everybody, people don't know, right? And so sometimes people might say, how many people go to college? 70% of the population. That's not true. It's not true. But certainly a high percentage of population goes through K through 12 school. So that's where we can reach people. And so you're giving them real a curriculum, but also pedagogical tools and enhancement so that the teacher understands what they're doing, even to the level of language, and to explain to them what is the diaspora and what is, you know. So I think I want you to talk about that, and to me that's hugely impactful. And then we can talk about the 9,000 who do the Frederick Douglass days and things like that. But yeah.
We started the Colored Conventions Project in 2012, and we really thought about how we could get to curriculum from the beginning, and it was delayed. And by that I mean we had to build the exhibits so that we could then build a curriculum to go with the exhibits. We needed to publish the book, all right, and then create exhibits that accompany the book, although the exhibits came first in our case, and right as the articles of the book were in process and in production. And then to create a teaching tab on all of these exhibits, to make it really easy for both college teachers and K through 12 teachers to adopt a curriculum about a movement that so few of us knew anything about, that had been disremembered from history. So acknowledging one of the principles of both DigBlack, which stands for Digitize Black Records, Excavate Black History, Dignify Black Scholarship, Love Black Communities. So both DigBlack and DigBlack, right? Excavate, dig, right? Dig as in love. Digitize, right? Dignify.
I love the acronym. I didn't see the acronym. But the acronym's not here online.
It's not. I've been trying to press our team to put it on the website for a little while. So DigBlack is very deeply invested in our public-facing principles, in acknowledging the labor of the people who do the work as our partners and in our team. So I need to call out Denise Berger, who is the head of curriculum and community engagement and has done all of this excellent work. But also to acknowledge the labor of public school teachers who are underfunded, grievously so, and overworked. So we want to make this as easy as possible for them to adopt. And we do so through these teaching tabs and these teaching materials. That said, and speaking of what's on the website, we're also interested in ensuring that this can happen outside of classrooms. So any of us, again, who understand and study the 19th century or the 18th century know that learning communities that are sanctioned by the state are often also places where our history and the ways in which we teach it is prohibited by the state. And so we've created alternate places where that learning can occur, and that places have, those places have included community centers, reading rooms, and churches. And so we want this curriculum to also be useful to adult learners who are interested, to adult learners who want to teach their children, to people who are homeschooling their children because they literally aren't safe in some of our schools. So thinking through those kinds of questions are really important, or is really important. Thinking through singular is really important. But also, isn't named on our site, which says K through 12 in college, right? And so I think we also need to go rethink the ways in which we situate that knowledge so that we can also be clear that we mean to include people who are not learning in traditional spaces or in sanctioned spaces.
So I've got a couple more questions with the time we have left. One, you know, you talked to me about this Douglass Day, where 9,000 people got on to look at the website. How can people get involved with that?
Douglas Day is a global transcribe-a-thon that grew out of our creating a portal and a partnership with the AME Church. So a lot of the conventions were held in spaces controlled by Black communities, and the African Methodist Episcopal Church is one of those places. And in addition to that, the first convention was held by Richard Allen in the last year of his life in Mother Bethel in Philadelphia, right, the place where the AME Church was founded. And so thousands of people from the AME Church came to transcribe the records of the Colored Convention in our first transcribe-a-thon. Classrooms also did so, but we were really interested in how we could engage people in the preservation of their own history and to do that collectively, right, which was also one of our principles, is that we want to enact the process of the conventions in our own preservation of history. Out of that grew the revitalization of Douglas Day, which was a holiday that was founded by Mary Church Terrell and on February 14th, Frederick Douglass's chosen birthday. And it is because Frederick Douglass's birthday was celebrated, and it was only a week from Lincoln's birthday, that Carter G. Woodson, of course, chose, right, Black History Week, which turned into Black History Month. So we have Frederick Douglass and Mary Church Terrell to thank for February being Black History Month. It's not because it's the shortest month in the year, right? Yeah. So every Douglas Day, we have a party for our friends, as the founder, Jim Casey, who is the co-director of the center and was a graduate student in the class that founded the Colored Conventions project. Jim Casey and Denise Berger, who is the head of curriculum, get together to throw this huge party, and we transcribe Black records on that day. We have transcribed the records of Mary Church Terrell with the Library of Congress. We have transcribed the records of Anna Julia Cooper with the Moreland Spingarn Center and others. We have worked with the African American Museum of Philadelphia as a partner. We have worked with the Smithsonian with NMOC as a partner. And now we have a partnership with the Library of Congress. This year, the Library of Congress used its platform By the People, and we came together with Douglas Day. We're the organizers of Douglas Day. They have some of the records, and 9,000 people from four continents joined us to transcribe Black records. So we're really interested, again, in the collective work, the collective labor that allows us to make our history fully searchable and not behind paywalls. So that's the kind of work that we're doing together. We also have a bake-off, a birthday cake bake-off, and anyone can join us every February 14th for this global transcribe-a-thon, and you can find all of that at douglasday.org. There's a curriculum that is connected every year to that for teachers. We have more and more teachers and classrooms joining us. Middle schools joined us this year. We had a school in Ethiopia that joined us this year. We've had people in France who have joined us, Turkey, and across the United States and Canada, where we also transcribed Marianne Shad Carey's papers, which involved 2 years of organizing to make sure those papers were digitized before they could be transcribed.
I want to talk about the Dig Black principles. I'm going to read a couple. Dig Black affirms the connections between past and present organizing for Black people's dignity, rights, and justice. We seek to enact and expand on the values of collective organizing modeled by the movements and organizations we study. And really, then the final principle, principle 8, Dig Black affirms that Black artists and cultural makers sustain Black joy, health, and futures. We work with Black artists and arts organizations to preserve and share these histories. So, briefly, talk to me about the principles and really those two principles.
We're really humbled by the fact that the Colored Conventions Project is known for the way we do our work as it is for the work that we do. And for the many, many, many organizations, not only in digital humanities, but other kinds of public-facing initiatives and projects who have articulated principles because they have seen us do that publicly and foreground that, and because they also know that their work emerges from organizers who allow us to be here. Our principles were founded on the Jemez, or on the example of the Jemez, environmental movement principles. We just want to always acknowledge the people who have done the work to incubate our own. One of the things that the convention movement shows us is how easily scattered records are disappeared. And those are the scattered records of any people whose history is not valorized, validated, and collected. And because it is so ephemeral, so easily erasable, and at every stage, as Michelle Trujillo tells us, right, of production and of recuperation, then it is important for us to acknowledge the cultural griots who have preserved that history, the artists and the poets and the storytellers who have been so central to keeping our culture and our history alive. Langston Hughes' grandfather, you'll hear tonight, was in the convention movement. In fact, went to with his brother, John Mercer Langston, Charles Langston, his grandfather, went to more than 20 conventions. His great uncle, John Mercer Langston, started going to conventions when he was 19, right? And then is the president of Howard, the founding dean of Howard Law School, right? Has hosts countless Black lawyers in his home, right? Who are organizing for justice in a variety of ways. He is a frenemy of Frederick Douglass. And I think we also need to think about the kind of heterogeneity of thought. This is the work that you do in such stellar ways when you're talking about Black power and as one of the founders of what people often call the Black, right, power school of thought. Seeing that kind of heterogeneity of thought, even as we have a fairly uniform, and by we again, I mean Black people, African people, diasporic people, have a fairly uniform, particularly in the United States, a vision of wanting to get to freedom and equality. But the strategies, not to mention the tactics, right? There are large fights about that. And we are human people, and human people are always people who have a heterogeneic, right, sort of sensibility about the ways in which we are going to get to the places we need to go. And that is documented as well. The cultural work that is embedded through music, through prayer, through art, right, is central to Black health and to the Black preservation of history. And it is also a more egalitarian way to know about that history. So we partner with dancers. Dr. Lynette Overby has been a partner for 12 years, is doing work, has done dances on Marianne Shad Carey for Douglass Day. She's about to do one for our Francis Harper initiative for the 200th anniversary of Francis Harper. We have worked with Mural Arts Philadelphia, the largest public arts organization in the United States, to get the first mural of the convention movement, which is in Philadelphia, where the movement was founded and where five of the first six conventions were held. So this way that people can interact with things visually, can put a QR code right next to it and come to a digital exhibit if they like, right, is a way in which we are both fed spiritually, I would say. Recovery is a word that is both about historical recovery, but it's also a word that speaks to health, right? And that work has been ably, I think, in the hands of our artists and cultural makers.
So my final question, what inspires you? We've been talking about this, but what inspires you?
Art inspires me. Right, poetry inspires me. A word well turned, right? A phrase well turned gives me great joy. I really am a poet's daughter. So beautiful writing inspires me. Nature inspires me. But the thing that inspires my work is the beauty of being able to pass the baton on to people who come after us and are beside us, passing that baton back and forth, which this podcast is an example of, you're doing, right, is both inspiration and responsibility. I am a student of Barbara Christian, the great founder of African, one of the great founders of African American Black women's literary history. I'm a student of Earl Lewis, the historian. I'm a student of Julius Lester, the SNCC photographer, and truth teller, even when it was very difficult and cost a lot. And I'm not of his own truth. And being able to be in collectives generates ideas that are so much better than my own ideas. So I'm almost always inspired by being in collectives of people where there's an ethics of care, not only for the material, but for each other. And that extends to equitable pay, to lack of debt, to real acknowledgement, right, to the watering of ideas that are not our own, and to the acknowledgement of the fact that we are not the generators by ourselves in the kind of work that I do of the kinds of initiatives and projects that we can pass on to the next generation in ways that will seed a field that, and I mean that, the field, right, both the disciplinary field and the symbolic field of American democracy in ways that we could never do alone in moments where people are really trying to turn the hose off.
Wow. Thank you, Gabrielle Forman. Dr. Gabrielle Forman is an award-winning professor, the paternal family chair of liberal arts at Penn State University, MacArthur Genius Fellow, the co-founder and co-director of the Center for Digital Black Research and DigBlack. And we've been talking about her nationally acclaimed Colored Conventions Project, where she's the founding faculty director. And certainly I want to thank all the people who are connected to the Colored Conventions Project, everybody who's been connected with this. Dr. Forman has been talking about the artists and the students and the teachers. And this is such a great collective work for justice. It's been an inspiring conversation. Everyone can find the Colored Conventions Project at coloredconventions.org. There's also an anthology everyone should pick up called The Colored Conventions Movement, Black Organizing in the 19th Century. That's a really brilliant anthology edited by Dr. Forman, but also Jim Casey and Sarah Lynn Patterson. And this is really, even though we're calling it a Colored Conventions Project, it really is a movement. It's really transformed. This is part of why Dr. Forman won the MacArthur Genius Prize, but it's really transformed how we think about digital Black history, the capacities and contours of it. We need one in Texas, everyone, desperately. So thank you so much for speaking with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode, and you can check out related content on Twitter at Peniel Joseph. That's PENIELJOSEPH. And our website, csrd.lbj.utexas.edu. And the Center for Study of Race and Democracy is on Facebook as well. This podcast was recorded at the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.